Bill Hader. Dan Aykroyd pulled me aside after my third episode, and I sat with him and we talked for like 2 hours at the after party. And Dan Aykroyd's like, "Here's what's going to happen. You're going to be really nervous, you're not going to know where you stand, and then the audience is going to understand you, the audience is going to like you, and then you're going to have a couple of seasons where things are going great. And then it's going to turn into you just clocking in. You clock in, you do your stuff, and you clock out, you go home. When you're just clocking in, that's around the time you should go." And that eighth season, I kind of felt that. I was like, yeah, I come in, I land my stuff, I didn't go to after parties, I had kids, so maybe that subconsciously was there. My third episode, he essentially telegraphed my entire career at the show. He was just like, "Here's what's going to happen." And he was 100% right. I actually thought about that at my last show. I was like, fuck, Dan Aykroyd was right. As their generation faded from cultural dominance, so baby boomers themselves began departing one by one. Not just from the cast, but from this mortal coil and veil of tears. As the show celebrated one anniversary after another, the necrology of Saturday Night Live grew longer and crueler. One of the most painful deaths for the show's founders was that of Tom Davis, who had been among the first writers to sign on in 1975. He and fellow comic Al Franken, hired as a team, performed together in addition to writing. Their great sketches for others included Dan Aykroyd's uproarious impersonation of a hemorrhaging Julia Child. Collaborating with Aykroyd, Davis memorably created a family of misshapen, beer-swilling outer space aliens called the Coneheads. Collaborating with Bill Murray, he created Nick, the lousy lounge singer, who tried imparting lyrics to the theme from Star Wars, among other acts of impertinent overreaching. Davis and Franken later broke up, Franken said, because of Davis's troubling problems with addiction. Franken went on to the United States Senate, of all places, and Davis, who called himself a hippie most of his life, returned to SNL for another stint, on his own, from 1986 to 1994. His connection to the show lasted beyond that tenure, albeit sporadically and for financial reasons. As he recalled several years before his death, "Every once in a while I'll show up and be a guest writer on a show if the coffers are getting low out here. Lorne will let me come back and appear on the show and make some money right away. It's not because they need me or that Lorne was particularly going, 'Geez, I wish Tom Davis would come back to the business.' Although the cast and the writers all tell me that they're glad to see me, and I believe them." In July of 2012, he died of cancer, his death having no apparent relationship to his earlier years of drug use. Knowing he was terminal, Davis joked even about death, referring to it as deanimation, and blogging not long before the end, "Some of my best friends are dead," and, "Fortunately for me, I have always enjoyed mystery and solitude." Michaels said, "I always trusted Tom's laugh. I can kinda still hear it." Charles Charlie Rocket could be said to have committed suicide twice. The first time it was career suicide, when he audibly ad-libbed the verboten word fuck during a 1981 sketch spoofing the hit soap Dallas, and was fired from the show. Rocket, who had been considered a bright new hope for the then-struggling program, had anchored Weekend Update for a season and remained an actor after leaving the show. But tragically, in October of 2005, he walked out into a field near his Connecticut home and took his life by slitting his throat. Charlie Rocket was 56. Tom Davis was 59.
Aaron Doyle, producer. When Tom Davis died, we had a memorial in 8H, and I was lucky enough to help Lorne produce it, essentially. We had everyone come back from those early years. Dan Aykroyd spoke, Bill Murray spoke, Jim Downey spoke, along with a lot of other people. Jane Curtin was there. Everyone was there. It kind of made 8H feel like a church. Also, we were able to have the current cast attend, and just watching the old and the new casts mix was really interesting. Very few people get to choose their families, or have to audition for them. Young people may dream and plan for years about becoming part of SNL, but no matter how warmly they are embraced, or whether it exceeds their expectations or falls sadly short, SNL sends no one away unaffected by the experience.
Justin Timberlake. The last time I hosted, Lorne was able to bring in all of the classic, iconic SNL giants to be a part of the first sketch. I mean, I grew up watching these people, you know? Martin and Chevy, Tom Hanks, Alec Baldwin, and Candace Bergen. It blew my mind. And that Paul Simon would be part of that moment as well, that blew my mind. I was host and musical guest, and Three Amigos was a huge movie in my childhood. So the fact Steve and Martin and Chevy were game to wear the Three Amigos costumes to introduce my musical performance is something I will never forget.
Cecily Strong, cast member. I remember when I was about 5 years old, fighting with every babysitter and telling them my parents let me stay awake late so I could watch the show. That's one of my earliest memories. And then copying every sketch and performing it. My friend Susanna and I went to this beach lodge in Michigan with my family every vacation, and my parents split up, so I got to go with my divorced dad and bring my best friend for a couple of years. I would always direct sketches and make everybody do plays, and we would play these two Chicago news people, Jim Giovanni and Joe DiMario, and we were just being the super fans, talking about Ditka, and we kept saying cheers to beers and that kind of thing. We had a VHS of the commercials, I remember, that I watched almost every day. They were my favorites. It's always been my number one dream. I've always been drawn to the stage and did all that growing up. I got my BFA in theater from CalArts, and now I get to perform live comedy in front of an audience and get to change it every week. It's amazing. I get to dress up, change my hair and makeup. It's Halloween every week. A month after my first screen test, they told us we were going to be flown out for another one. So I had to come up with a new set of characters and impressions. And every step of the way, I was like, I'm out. I'm done. I kept thinking of all these reasons why they wouldn't choose me, because that's the way my brain works. I even got a weird message from my manager saying, I just talked to Lindsay and she's saying that casting works in weird ways and sometimes they don't cast people until mid-season. And I thought, so that all sounds negative. I'm just going to deal with my rejection now. And then, about 20 minutes later, my agent calls and says, you're being flown out to meet with Lorne. I said, is that good? And he was like, well, he's not going to fly you out to tell you that he doesn't like you. I was hired in this weird limbo of, we don't know when you'll start, just get out here Monday. I came out prepared to write and was told the Wednesday before the first week that I was going to be on the show. I had to run downstairs to have pictures taken. They didn't have a dress in my size, so I was like a stuffed sausage squeezed into a cape dress. Adie Bryant, cast member. I think maybe the biggest surprise would be how sort of instantly people respect you in a way that maybe should take you much longer. People immediately, when you have gone through being on SNL, even for... I've only been here for 2 years, and yet I feel like people within the industry are, like, really impressed by that and take you seriously much more quickly than if, say, I think if, like, you know, I had just started on a sitcom or something. Just immediately, you're like, oh, this is the big leagues.
Colin Jost, writer. I was a writer, then a writing supervisor, which is just kind of a transitional title, the year before I became head writer, and so I started taking on some of those duties with Seth to start learning that job. It was gradual over the course of 3 years. There's a lot more anxiety in being head writer. That's the biggest change from writer to head writer. You feel a responsibility for the show. Obviously, it's Lorne's show, and there's no question about that. But you feel a responsibility. It changes from being a really fun job to being a challenging and stressful job. What's crazy about the anxiety is that they're your friends, people you hang out with. And before you got that job, you were talking to them and saying, Can you believe this person? That's crazy. And suddenly you have a hand in that, and that feels really weird, and you have to start thinking as a producer rather than a writer or cast member. You have to think about what's best for the show and not what's best for your friends. That's at least half the anxiety. The hardest thing to deal with up front was feeling you should have a strong opinion at every meeting. I'd been in a lot of meetings before, but Lorne was either not asking me what I thought or not relying on it. And then suddenly it felt like he was, and that he was giving me leeway to shape the show, which is intimidating. If certain things don't work, you say, I should have made that better. I should have seen that it wouldn't work. But there's also a limit to what you can do. You're one in a staff of a lot of people, and a lot can go right or wrong that has nothing to do with you. You're only one small part of it, but you try to do what you can. The beauty of the show is that you start over again the next week, and you don't have many hours to lick your wounds. Bill Hader. I never understood the pitch meetings. Wait, I take that back. I understood the pitch meetings. I just never liked the pitch meetings, because I was never very good at it. A pitch meeting is essentially telling the host, here's who you'll be working with this week. And instead of someone shaking their hand and saying, hi, my name is Bill, I'll be working with you this week, I pitch you an idea. The other reason to do it is if something's happening, if something's in the zeitgeist and it's topical, people can lay claim to it at a pitch meeting. I say that I want to do something about Sarah Palin or whatever, and then they work that out. Or if I say, I have this idea where I play Vincent Price, it's kind of telling the room, hey, I'm doing Vincent Price this week, so don't do anything that bumps with it. Taryn Killam. I think it works out differently for different people. For myself, absolutely. You sit down on writing night, and it's almost musical. The rhythms, saying something and hearing the rhythm and knowing, no, that doesn't feel right. Because you're also writing for a minimum of four audiences. You're writing for the room on Wednesday. You're writing for Lorne in particular. And then you're writing for the audience that's coming in here, the 300 tourists, aunts, and uncles that are coming in. And then you're writing for yourself, because you want to be happy with what you do. Bill Hader said it's like this diagram, and you have to find what you think is funny and what the show thinks is funny, and the section where they both overlap. And that's the type of material you should be writing for the show. Bill Hader. Steve Higgins always talks about Venn diagrams, like, here's what you find funny, and here's what the show finds funny. And you have to find that Venn diagram of where both areas overlay. Kristen Wiig, John Mulaney, those are people for whom it's all the same circle. What they naturally like 100% works for the show. I felt like I had to find my Venn diagram. It took me four seasons to figure out how to get a thing that I was happy with, but that worked for the show. I think for certain people it's just really hard. Fred Armisen. I think you never know, because even if you and the writers laugh in the office, you still never know. And if everyone laughs at the rehearsal table, you still never know. And even if it goes to dress rehearsal, you're not there. Even if it goes to air and everyone's laughing and it goes great, that second time it doesn't mean that they're going to be there for you. I actually feel like the only time that I know if something has worked is after it's aired, or even a few months after, to see who's remembered it or who's said something about it on the street. Otherwise, you just don't know. It's hard to get a sense of it because it's people talking to you about you, so obviously they're not going to tell you something critical.
A.D. Bryant. For my first four or five shows, I had almost no lines. Maybe one line here, one line the next week. And then all of a sudden, I hosted a presidential debate, and that was like a huge switch. And there was a lot on my shoulders for a change. And because it was a town hall debate, it was this really insane cue card setup where they were shooting over my shoulder. So that meant I could not have any cards in front of me, because they would be in the shot. It was very stressful and very crazy because for a while they were like, you might have to memorize the whole thing, but we're going to change it. So it was like this insane big moment that I could tell was a make or break. Either I could execute it or I couldn't. Romney and Obama were taking questions from the audience, basically this town hall, and I was Candy Crowley moderating these questions. It was shot in the round, almost, which is really rare for SNL. So they had two cue card guys dressed as extras sitting in the audience with cards at their feet. And any time they knew that they weren't on screen, they would stand up and pop up the card so that I could grab one line and then stick them back down. If you watch that scene, you can see in the background that there are cue card guys sitting there like extras and then popping up with these cards. It was an insane feeling. And then when it finished, I got to the final thing where I say, "That concludes our debate," and now when I watch it, I can fully see in my face, I'm like, "Woo! We made it through!" I'm so overwhelmed and happy, and then I said, "Live from New York," and all of a sudden, Tom Hanks was on one side of me and Bill Hader on the other, and we ran down this hallway, and people had lined the hallway to clap for me because it was definitely my first big thing on the show. It was like the most special moment of my life, you know?
James Downey. I used to write this stuff with Al Franken when we started out. I was a standard-issue Harvard graduate commie, and Al was like a Democratic Party stalwart. He was wherever the party was, and I had contempt for the partisan stuff. And I became more conservative over the years, to the point where I'm now a conservative Democrat, which means in Hollywood terms I'm a McCarthyite, I suppose. But I have to say, and even Franken agrees with me, I've talked to him about this, that the last couple seasons of the show were the only two in the show's history where we were totally like every other comedy show, basically an arm of the Hollywood Democratic establishment. There was nothing we did politically that in any way set us apart from any other political comedy show. In fact, Stewart was more nuanced. We just stopped doing anything which could even be misinterpreted as a criticism of Obama. We were doing what we had often been unfairly accused of doing, but this time it was true. Except our critics just said, "Oh, they've always been that way." And I would go, "No, not so." It's not a matter of left-right, it's more a matter of with the pack. We were now with the pack of comedy shows as opposed to being sort of hard to peg. And that had been one of the things I was always proud of about the show.
Kate McKinnon. Chris Kelly and Sarah Schneider, two brilliant writers, wrote several incarnations of Ann Romney for me to do, and then finally landed on that one for Weekend Update. I had nothing to do with the writing at all, although I had been watching her, and although I'm not a Republican, I really liked something about her. There was this quality that was like buttoned up, but you could tell that inside she was a little loose, a little ready to get down. So I really enjoyed her as a character, just playing with that. Paula Pell, writer. A lot of times, people auditioning for SNL came from that sea of improvisational comedians, Second City and Groundlings and UCB, and oftentimes that community of people was not quite as diverse as you would wish. There's plenty of funny gay women and men who do gay content in their comedy, and they are in venues that are within their community. But you really have to try with the internet and everything to get your stuff out there to where people will see it. Sometimes it was hard because obviously there are far more men than women in a lot of these groups, gay or straight, in the mainstream at least. And you would sit there and see a whole group of women auditioning and think, "Wow, I know there's got to be funnier ladies out there. These ladies are funny." But you want those Kristen Wiggs, those brilliant, funny women. You know they exist, but you've got to find them. You've got to get them in there. You've got to audition them. Kate McKinnon. I didn't think that anyone was talking about me in the same sense as Kristen Wiig, because that's ludicrous. She's the finest sketch performer that ever lived, and I have not proved myself at all. But I did feel a lot of pressure, personal pressure, because her career at SNL was so astounding, and I admired her so much that I held myself to that standard just internally. And that probably tripped me up a little bit. It drove me a little crazy. I put too much pressure on myself. I eat too much, and I'm a terrible hypochondriac, and I think that I'm going to have an aneurysm or something. I take my pulse a lot. Paula Pell. Kate is of a generation that grew up differently than I did. You know, I'm 51, and there was one mainstream movie about two lesbians called Personal Best, and I had the cassette of it hidden in my drawer. And now when I look at my nieces, who are the same ages as Kate McKinnon, they grew up with MTV and entertainment shows and reality shows, all with tons of gay characters, and episodic shows with tons of gay characters that weren't just about them being gay. They were part of a love triangle. They were part of a medical drama. It's now such a mainstream thing that I don't feel like the pressure was as big on her. But who knows her personal experience with that? I do know that there are lots of young gay girls who love knowing that Kate McKinnon is on there as a cast member, and that they're being represented, because everybody is trying to be represented. It's also hard to write sketch comedy that spans across humanity and not have the cast do those things. As comedy and comedy subjects and pop culture things become more diverse and more interesting, we need the cast to support that. And so I'm really super glad that we're getting a much more diverse cast. It's been a great joy. James Anderson and I, who are best friends and were roommates in college and have worked together at SNL for years and years, were about the only gay people on the writing staff for a long time. And that has changed a lot. It's just so wonderful now to know that there's a nice collection of people there that really covers it all. Kate McKinnon. I never wanted it to stop me in my life, and so far it hasn't, and that's wonderful. I just want to be a regular comedian. That's the banner I fly. I don't really have much to say about it, I guess. I'm glad I could make a difference and get paid at the same time.
Kenan Thompson. I started watching SNL toward the end of the Eddie Murphy years. I was aware of the hot tub sketch and stuff as a little kid, but it was more what my dad was laughing at. For me, it was like Sandler and Farley and those guys, Kevin Nealon, Norm, and the others. I had to go backwards to appreciate the earlier things. I wasn't really a fan of Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase, because those guys were movie stars. As far as their work on the show, I had to research those years. Lorne Michaels. 90% of the people working here now weren't alive during the first 5 years. Kenan Thompson. It's unbelievably gracious of God to give me this gift. You know what I'm saying? I don't know how else to put it. I can't even watch the show the same way now. It seems like a totally different show now that I'm on it. It's crazy. It's crazy to imagine your picture at some point in that long line of headshots that we have up there on the wall. Eventually, you'll get to your picture. Paul Rudd. That show has seen its share of pretty incredible talents, and I always thought Armisen was one of them. There have always been people who have very specific comedic sensibilities that sometimes I thought, how does it fit in with the show? When Armisen first joined SNL, I wondered. He's so specifically funny and so interesting and so left of center. And then he just owned it, and it was so fun to watch his specific kind of thing come through. Fred Armisen. I'm here with who I love. I'm here with Carrie Brownstein, my soulmate. I'm here with my friends and playing music. I wrote on my guitar strap, T-Y-L-M, I heart you. Thank you, Lorne Michaels, I love you. That's just kind of the way I wanted to do it. I wanted it to be musical. You know that thing in music where it's positive even though it still has little tinges of melancholy to it? I still wanted it to be a sort of happy, sad song. James Downey. You get to be a certain age, and it's like I get more and more disconnected from the general thing of the show. First of all, I'm old enough to be their fathers, and then I'm old enough to be their, not grandfathers, I guess, but I don't know what the future will hold. Seth Meyers. The minute Lorne and I started talking about late night as a possibility, I made sure I could come back to SNL the first half of the season. I was in no way, shape, or form emotionally ready to leave. The timing of it would have meant, I think, that I only had one more show, and I certainly wasn't ready to unpack all my feelings about that in such a short period of time. It's sort of like finding out from your doctor that you have 6 months to live, and so those last 6 months are still very vivid and bright. And that's kind of how I felt about SNL.
Cecily Strong. Every time I have a meeting with Lorne, I assume I'm getting fired. It's like seeing a doctor and you assume they're going to tell you that you have AIDS, even if it's a dentist. So I was really scared, and we just chatted for a while, and then he said, "I'm going to have you do update." I had no idea he was even thinking about it. And then he was like, "Well, I'm going to go. I'm taking someone to dinner." And so then I was just left with Doyle. What just happened? I'm going to do update? Do I have to change who I am? Does this mean I can't be as outspoken now that I have to represent this brand? Because I've always been loud-mouthed Chicago kid. I don't have paparazzi following me. Nothing like that is part of my life. But anything I put out there now, I feel so scared about guarding everything. In January, after a show, I was on Twitter, and I was getting all these mean ones. Some were really sexist and nasty, and so many were, "Are you pregnant? Are you pregnant?" And I just felt like, hey, I have to deal with my body, my own self, my own image issues. Why should the public get to weigh in and be bullies about it? I couldn't decide what to do for months, and then I thought, I'm just going to say one thing, and then after I've said it, I'm only going to address the nicer ones. I think I just said, "No, I'm not pregnant, you bully dickheads," or something along those lines. Then Lorne was on me for "watch your language" or something, and I said, "Am I allowed to say how I feel? Are we allowed to stick up for ourselves? I'm with you on swear words. My mother would say the same thing, and I trust my mother. Get your point across without swear words. But I want to make sure I have the right to be myself." Figuring all that out has been tough. Cameron Diaz. They always know who's in town somehow. I'm friends with Adam Levine, so I was planning on coming to the show that week anyway. I was going to go, "Dude, can I get tickets?" But then I got a phone call from Lauren's office, and they said, "We have this sketch and we'd like you to be in." And when they said it would be with Adam and with Jerry Seinfeld, I was like, are you kidding me? Being sandwiched between Adam and Jerry was a thrill for me. I didn't even care what I had to say.
Seth Meyers. What you learn from Lorne, and certainly, hopefully, will have learned from me, just as someone who's been there for a long time, is that by design, the show has ups and downs, mostly because it's impossible to constantly be rolling out. So you have people who are veterans, people who are new, people who are just coming along, and sometimes that alchemy gets a little off. But if it's such that at any given time you have too many people that are new, that just means that in a year or two, you'll have a great many people who are completely coming into their own. So it was great to be here this year and for people to watch Kate McKinnon and Vanessa Bayer, who have grown up so much in the last few years, and it's just been a delight to see them do their thing. And to be at the update desk with Cecily is something I'll never forget. Rob Klein, writer. It's like, oh my God, you lose so many of the stars of the show or whatever, you know, with Bill, Fred, and Jason, and Andy and Kristen the year before. I mean, obviously that's been the history of the whole show going all the way back, and it's always been okay. And the thing that I even remember going back to my first year is like, Bill Hader was just kind of a guy. And even like Bill, Jason, and Fred, when they started, everyone was like, okay, those are just the new guys, and they were almost like not that distinguishable in some ways. It's like Phil Hartman. He's one of the best people who's ever been on the show. He, the audience, and even the people at the show can't quite see what they're going to become yet. And maybe they don't quite know either. But that's the thing that's made me feel better this year, is remembering back to my first year. Even Kristen wasn't necessarily the star of the show. People grow into all of these roles, and it happens kind of quickly, too.
Lindsay Shukas. You can't replace Jason, Fred, and Bill. You can't go out and find the next Bill Hader, just like you can't go out and find the next Will Ferrell. And if you set yourself up for that, you're bound for failure. But if we maybe hire a few extra, maybe we'll find some real gems in there.
Bill Hader. You have these hosts come in and go, "Hey, I'm on SNL, let's party." And we were like, "Oh, I'm not eating sugar this season." I remember my mother-in-law came in, and I won't name the band, but friends of the band who played the show said, "Hey, can we, like, hang out in your dressing room and maybe smoke a joint?" And I said, "Yeah, I don't give a shit," 'cause I rarely was in my dressing room. And I forgot I told them that, and I came after the show with my mother-in-law, and there was the band smoking pot, and I was like, "Oh, my mother-in-law," and they were like, "Ew," and ran out. And then my father-in-law, who's a judge in Idaho, that was like around Christmas, so then we go to Idaho for Christmas, and he sits me down and says, "Your mother-in-law told me about what happened, and I just want you to know you've got to watch it with drugs and stuff in your business, because I don't want you to get caught with something, and that reflects poorly on you. You've really got to watch it." And I said, "You don't understand. Where I work was founded on pot. If pot didn't exist, there would be no SNL. The reason I have this awesome job is that these guys were doing a lot of drugs. So relax. It's all right."
Tina Fey, cast member. I think I maybe would have fit in the Jane Curtin model, which is, I don't think Jane used to, like, do blow with everybody. Jane was, like, already married when she came into the show.
Lorne Michaels. I know how it's written about, and I know what Aykroyd says in interviews about it, because he loves the myth of the old days. After the show, for sure, but during the show, when stuff was getting written, it was just too hard. It was always hard, you know? And I think people loved the idea of that myth, of the 70s myth. Also, there was no money for any of it in the first 2 or 3 years. That only happened after Animal House and that level of success. And it happened mostly with John. Chevy was gone. I wrote with Chevy a lot of times in that first year or year and a half, but he wasn't fucked up. James Anderson, writer. There are still some people who work there that talk about those days, and I don't know how they ever put on a show. There was some hardcore stuff going on back in the day. And now, you know, the hardcore stuff is like tequila shots, basically. That's the hardest thing that's going around. Maybe it's something to do with the era. When it started in the 70s, they were more experimental with drugs and stuff. They would get high when they were writing and stuff back in the day. The high we have is lack of sleep. You're just there until read-through. So it's coffee, Red Bull, and whatever else.
Maya Rudolph. Working there is also not just writing sketches and performing them, but also checking in with each other and talking to each other about your private life and your family and your, you know, your boyfriend or husband or whatever and your girlfriend or wife. It's knowing that you have to take care of each other, that these are the people that you're with 6.5 days out of the week, and they see you at your best and your worst and your most tired and eating crap food at 4 o'clock in the morning and when you're delirious. These are the people that are really taking care of you as well.
Lorne Michaels. When you're the boss, people project onto you. I can generally tell how people got along with their parents, or more specifically, how they got along with their fathers, if they had an adoring one or if they had a contentious one. Every time I speak, they hear criticism. Gilda Radner called every night to talk about a guy she was breaking up with, and John Belushi would drop by my apartment at 3 o'clock in the morning to go over things. I remember being in my office somewhere in the end of the first season, and Herb Sargent coming in and saying he had to talk to me. So I said, "What is it?" And he said, "I don't know what to do with my life. What do you think?" He was like 30 years older than I was, and I went, "Oh, Jesus." Ken Among. We now do more pre-recorded material than we've ever done before. When we come into a show now, I'll read everything on Wednesday morning before everyone gets here. It's usually about 40 scripts, and I would say about 10 to 12 of those are pre-recorded pieces, whereas years ago it might be 2 or 3. Over the course of the last 5 years, with the advent of digital shorts, Akiva, Yorma, and Andy and those other guys grew in power, and they were all good. The new writing staff is fairly young, the YouTube generation, and that's the way they're used to seeing things. They think more filmically than we did in the past. We still do the same number of live pieces as well. They're pitted against one another to fight for the airtime.
Kate McKinnon. I do wonder what it was like not to have the immediate feedback of the internet the next day. Ultimately, I think that all change is bad, so yeah, I think it's more a curse than a blessing. Because as I'm rehearsing throughout the week, I'm thinking about how this is going to live forever. Not in some archive, but on the internet, and on blogs people are going to write things about. I don't think SNL was in the paper every week in 1995. Everyone's a comedian now. Everyone's on social media commenting in a joking way, and everything becomes immediate fodder for comedy. Doing sketch comedy has become harder, because the pace of it is impossible.
Bill Hader. I remember Emily Spivey, a writer on the show. I was telling her, oh man, I can't remember the website. So-and-so really didn't like that sketch. Maybe we shouldn't try it again. She was like, Bill, who the fuck cares? Why are you putting all of your worth into somebody you don't know? You don't know who they are, and they're just spouting shit about you. And I thought she had a point, and I just stopped. It's just like, who the fuck cares? And what I learned later, this is me talking now, was that they would reverse their opinion on things. Someone would love you and say these things, and a year later they hated you, and vice versa. I remember one of the websites hated Herb Welch. They were just like, please get rid of this character. It's my least favorite character. And I wasn't reading stuff online, but the people I wrote the sketch with were, and they were like, oh yeah, people fucking hate Herb Welch. I did an interview with them for a movie I was in, and they said, we want to get a comment from you because Herb Welch is in our favorite sketches of the year thing. And I was like, wait, what? It's this weird yo-yo thing, going up and down and just not knowing. And then it's affecting your work. Then you're sitting in front of your computer going, oh, okay, I'm writing this thing that people hate. People don't hate it. It's this one little area. Why would that affect your work? I'd rather have, if a good friend or a colleague or another comedian I respected or someone like that said, hey, I like that, or I'm not really into that, or whatever, then that means something, I guess.
Paula Pell. With the internet, it's just a barrage. Just a barrage of negativity, and everyone always says, oh, I try not to read that stuff. And it's just bullshit, because you know Sunday. They go online and they Google their sketch and they see what people said about it, and that affects them, you know? It affects writers, new writers, and actors. Kate McKinnon. I do like to read the internet. I read every blog every week because I'm just so jazzed that people watch it, and I want to know what they liked and what they didn't like. And I've learned to absorb whatever criticism I read, and I really like to see what people have to say about the writing, what they respond to. I feel a little more divorced from it now than I used to be. I would cry initially if I read something negative. I was really out of my mind. Now I take it to heart if I feel it's correct. Cecily Strong. It was almost becoming self-abusive or something. Like, if I had gotten a lot on that week and other people hadn't, it's like cutting yourself or something to read bad things. You know how it feels. For some reason, they like us to be competitive. They like to make it as if it's a competition, and that is the opposite of my happy, healthy place. I like ensembles and supportive environments. Vanessa Bayer. I think that no matter what the setup of the cast is, people will always have comments about what it should be. People will always have an opinion. When people think about SNL, they feel a lot of ownership over it. It's like a sports team. They have really strong opinions about who should be here and what should be on the show and everything. So it's a blessing and a curse. When I was in Facebook, someone would put an article on my page and say, "Oh, they said such a nice thing about you." So I would read it, and of course, right before that nice thing is a dig. So I really try not to look at the internet anymore. Sometimes my dad will tell me stuff. I think my dad must have figured out how to do a Google alert, because he always knows everything. It was my first season or something, and he offhandedly said, "You know, there's a whole page devoted to people who don't like you." And I was like, "Dad, I did not know that." I went to Thanksgiving this year, and my aunt was like, "Did you know there's a whole thing about your feet online?" There's a thing online where people have a foot thing. People who've been on TV with their foot exposed have a website. But I don't want to promote it in any way, or maybe I already have. Cecily Strong. I was in Hawaii over the break, and I was having just a bad day. Just at the pool, something happened, I don't even remember what, but I was crying and wearing sunglasses. I cry all the time. And later I see on Twitter somebody wrote, "I'm sitting right beside Cecily at the pool," and I was like, "God, I was crying the whole time." Luckily, she can't see, but even in Maui, tucked away, someone sees you.
Kenan Thompson. I used to walk to work a lot, especially when I moved into the city and lived closer to work, and a lot of the FedEx people would shout, "Yeah, what's up, man? Yeah, I seen you on the show. You're funny." It started with the delivery dudes.
Kristen Wiig. No matter what, a hug from Kenan made everything better.
Kenan Thompson. It's too crazy to focus on that and focus on where you work and focus on who you're coming behind. There's a list of crazy people who have come before. I walk past their pictures in the hall every single day, so it's already in my mind. It'll panic you to death. It really will. Jay Farrow. You'll have a role here that's not really funny. You're being a team player, and everything's about being a team player. In everything. That's how people get to the Super Bowl. I'm sure if Richie Sherman was fighting with the rest of the Seahawks, they wouldn't be anywhere right now. You gotta work together. That's what it's about, man. Whatever you get. It's all about whatever you get, being good at it, and having the writers see that and having them see you can do good in those things, and then they'll expand your role next time even bigger. Kenan Thompson. We don't get writers' credits, but everybody writes, you know, for the record. Some actually sit down and write on their own, and some collaborate. I'm more of a collaborator myself. I would say I'm a super collaborator because I don't actually type anything. We all write, we all stick to that process. I write every week. That's fine.
Kate McKinnon. In my mind, this is my last job. I am preparing for that being the reality. Obviously, I hope that I have a long career because I would feel bad if I couldn't work. Anything else beyond this would be icing on the cake. I'm putting my money in a tax-free municipal bond fund and just being very practical about savings, so if nothing else happens, then this would be enough. I already got so lucky getting this job. It seems like that would be too much to ask for, to continue to keep doing this, so I'll take it if it comes. But I don't want to hold myself to that standard. That's too much pressure. I've been basically unemployed or very sporadically employed for 6 years before getting this job, and I'm still pretty much there in my mind. So this is just a crazy thing that happened.
Bobby Moynihan. I'll stay here as long as they'll have me. This was my dream, and I should be thinking more about the future and more about movies, but I'm still worried. When I walk out this door, I want to be able to say to myself, "You did what you wanted to do and be happy with it." Those other jobs are nice, and they're not as hectic. Nothing is as hectic as this place, and I've been lucky enough to be in a couple of movies. But I love the idea of at 2 o'clock in the morning, someone comes into your office and says something stupid, and you go, "That might work," and you write it. And then a year later, you've done it 5 times, and you're like, "I can't believe that dumb joke turned into this amazing thing." When I started, Amy and Daryl were still on the show. It was a completely different place. I feel very lucky that I got to see what I think of as the tail end of old SNL, the Will Ferrell, Amy Poehler kind of days, and then got to see the meteoric rise of Kristen and Bill and Andy and all those guys. And now I'm getting to see all the new ones. It's crazy. I feel very lucky of my timing on the show. Sometimes I still feel like the new guy, but now that these other new guys are here, I feel like I can give advice and that it's worthy of listening to. I'm in no rush. Michael Shoemaker. Even if it's a good show, but it was a better dress, people are in a bad mood at the party. That thing that was better before doesn't matter, and yet it still affects them to this day. Like one of Seth's last shows that I went to, and he was like, "Yeah, I don't know, it was okay." I was like, "No, this is way better than last week." And he's like, "Yeah, but..." And it's just the comparison of dress to air, and they all kind of fall prey to it. Bill Hader. I was doing a sketch with Kristen Wiig where I was supposed to throw a milkshake in her face, and I did it perfectly on dress, and then on air I threw it and missed her, and it ruined the entire sketch. I totally overshot it, and literally the whole audience gasped. You could just tell it was supposed to be the big blast of the thing. Kristen just kind of froze. Then on the West Coast, they used the one from Dress. So the East Coast saw the fuck-up, but in the West, and in all the reruns, they played the one from Dress. That would happen a lot, where you would do something at Dress and be like, "Man, that went great." And then it just wouldn't go as well on air. If something went good at Dress, it was jinxed. You're like, "Fuck, it's never going to be that good again." Lorne could tell that I was being very hard on myself. So when that happened with the milkshake, he was like, "Don't worry about it." Andy Samberg. One time we did a sketch called Hamlet Auditions with Jude Law, because he'd just done Hamlet and Bill was doing his great Pacino, and he and other people were in a room getting ready to do Hamlet, and at one point I come storming in as Nick Cage, and I don't think I said two sentences before I do the thing from Wicker Man where I'm like, "The Beast! The Beast!" and run and jump out the window, which is obviously always a fun bit, to go through a window at SNL. And at dress rehearsal, I forgot to tuck my head under my arm, so I hit the bar, the severed wooden bar, right over my eye, and it cut my head open, and I just started gushing blood all over the crash mat. And I had to lie there so I didn't ruin the rest of the sketch as blood poured out of my head. And then finally they broke in, and I popped up, and I said to somebody, "Get help! Get a doctor! Get a doctor!" because I was in the next sketch. So Donna, who is in charge of the host's wardrobe and who has been doing it forever and knows every trick in the book, immediately goes, "I got it, I got it," and runs over with some kind of solution or something, holds some stuff up against it, and mooshes it down and does some magic thing to my head while my wardrobe guy Ken is changing my clothes. So they're still prepping me for the next change, and they got me changed out in time. And I had some weird skin glue stuck to my face for the next sketch, and then finally I came out and wiped all the makeup off and got it stapled up. And then I had to do it again on air, because Hamlet Auditions went well. So it was in the live show, and I had to go through the window again, knowing I had just busted my head open. But I tucked my head under my arm better this time, and I didn't cut myself. The sketch was probably tanking all week, and then all of a sudden it went, "Yes, this is the one you have to do."
Nassim Pedrad. You spend all this time working in the hopes that your crazy little idea sees the light of day, and then when it does, it's live television. So things can go wrong, and it's all happening so fast. The instance I'm remembering is the time I had a host accidentally leave our sketch before it was over. The host left early by a minute and a half without even realizing it. Lorne had to rerun an old commercial parody to make up for the lost time. The sketch awkwardly faded to black in the middle of one of our lines, and the whole thing was a mess. But I'd hate to throw the host under the bus, because it kind of wasn't his fault. My favorite part was the host sweetly came up to me during the goodbyes and was like, "Hey, we did it!" and I did not have the heart to tell him that we certainly did not.
Ken Among. Lorne's terrific when everybody's doing their best and something goes wrong. He can be disappointed, but sometimes he'll just laugh. It's just one of those things. I remember we had a sketch with Fred Armisen playing a character called Ravish. I actually had it put up online. It was in the 9th act of the show. We did another sketch up at the same location on home base, and then we had to do this Ravish talk show setup during the last break, which was a 1:30. It was a lot to set in a 1:30, but between the stagehands and me, we figured we could handle all the pieces. Well, the transition got underway, and it was clearly not going to happen. The sketches were in a different order at air than at dress, and there was a 3-wall setup on home base, with a chair, a couch, and a table, and a carpet to boot. Carpets are killers up on home base. So when I talk to the stagehands, they're all a very optimistic lot, and they're all, "We can do it." Well, sure enough, the countdown starts, and we're not even close. I don't know if it's still up online, but I have it on a DVD that I've saved forever, where the stage manager's walking down, trying to get some stuff up there, and he just goes, "We're screwed." And then the wall wouldn't connect to boot, so we did the whole scene with the wall being held up by 3 guys. But we made it. It wasn't pretty, but we made it.
Aaron Doyle. On Sunday, everyone goes away and clears their head, but Lorne comes back on Monday, and even if the show went well and was extremely successful, he still remembers exactly what the problems were on Saturday, and will go through the rundown that's on the board in his office on 17 with us. He sees all the flaws that played. He'll say, "Here's what happened in the cold open. This person missed their cue here." He can go through the entire show like that. It's kind of a crazy thing, or the way he's built and how he runs this place, but he knows how to break down the show on a very specific level. And then he'll say, "Look, we need to talk to the cast about this, or we need to talk to this department about this." I think every week he's disappointed, but he can also be extremely happy about the show and feel like, "Oh, it went well." The smallest stuff makes him really happy.
Ken Among. I'm in a weird position because while I've a vested interest that the show be funny, at that point in time for me it's really about the logistics of pulling the show together. On Thursdays I'm still in the early throes of organizing how we're going to do it. I'm in the elemental side of this. Anytime you read a script, I'm dealing with what are the 7 or 8 basic elements of television and every single piece I have to watch out for. Not that I have to create them or anything along those lines, but I have to make sure everybody's on the same path, on the same page. You have the director and the crew, costume design, scenic design, music, graphics, script, and cast, all those elements. And now the show's more complicated than it ever was before. Lorne always turns to me at the end of the thing. "Can you handle this?" I just think about it financially. At that point, I'm only thinking about it from a production standpoint. I have a personal criteria in terms of the live show that if we can actually rehearse the live show by Friday at midnight, I'm in pretty good shape there. I might have to make concessions on what we'll get to on Saturday, but I'll deal with that when we get to it. James Anderson. When Lorne is laughing, the whole world is laughing. When you're sitting next to Lorne and he's laughing, you're like, "All right, I've done it. I did it." Taryn Killam. I think at this point people know that as long as Lorne wants to do the show will survive. The interesting aspect is how it's going to transform, and who's going to take the reins or step up, or what's the new character or piece or segment. What was unique about our generation was that 4 of us got hired together, and we came into a locked cast. You had Kristen, who I think is one of the greatest performers in the history of the show. You had Andy, who helped change the structure of the show in terms of integrating social media and the internet. And then Bill, who's just one of the most versatile people of all time. And Jason and Fred. With those people, you don't need anybody else. You really don't. The original cast was 7, and adding us 4 made 13. So we were a little superfluous in terms of the necessity of the show.